Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Lisa Hendy just became the first woman to be named Chief Ranger at Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That means she's in charge of emergency operations for the park, which covers 800 square miles on the Tennessee-North Carolina border and is our most visited national park with 11.4 million visitors last year. Hendy spent 25 years in the Park Service and has experienced everything from dangerous rescues to mysterious wildlife encounters.
I heard this sound. It sounded like thunder. It was the craziest noise. I didn't know what it was, and it was coming down the canyon, and it was echoing off those walls, and it was so loud, and I'm like, what is that? So I, you know, sort of smashed myself up one side of the wall to sort of just get out of the way of whatever was coming down this canyon.
What did she see that day? And what's it like to work in a place that millions of people from around the world come to visit? Here's our conversation. So, Lisa, you've worked in national parks all over America, but you're from Tennessee. And I think I remember reading something that you called Great Smoky Mountains kind of your home park. So I'm wondering what memories you have of that place from growing up.
Yeah, I would say that the Smokies was the formative park as far as some of the first experiences I had in the backcountry, some of my first longer backpacking trips. And I would say that it was instrumental in helping me prepare as I started to learn about what it meant to spend time in the wilderness.
Did you spend a lot of time there? I mean, did you guys go fairly often when you were growing up?
You know, it was more after high school and college, and I would come up here and go backpacking either with my brother or with friends. And so it was later in my youth when I was out of school that I started really venturing out west after having spent many a spring break here in the Smokies.
Yeah. And were you always the kind of kid who, you know, when it got dark, somebody had to call you to come inside? Or, I mean, has that always been sort of a part of you?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up on Lookout Mountain and had in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And, you know, my friends and I, when we were very, very young, you know, we're talking anywhere from second grade all the way through sixth grade. We'd take off in the morning and came home when the lights came on and played in the woods, played in the creeks. And we were outside all day, every day.
And so was doing something like being a park ranger or working in the park service or something, was that something that was always something you might have aspired to do, or did you have other plans when you were younger?
Well, I always wanted to go into law enforcement, and I went to Auburn University and began as a criminal justice major, but realized fairly early on that a lot of the successful law enforcement folks were ending up in major cities, and I didn't want to end up in a city. And so I had a great professor who said you should look at the law enforcement component of land management agencies, and pointed me toward the Park Service, and that was a moment when everything clicked.
Yeah, yeah. And how long have you been working for the Park Service now?
Since 1994. Oh, I did an internship in 1994 in Yosemite.
And I was going to say, I know you've worked a little bit of everywhere. Where are some of the places that people might know about where you've been?
Yeah, so I spent several years in Rocky Mountain National Park early in my career, spent winters in Arches National Park in Moab, Utah, and went to Yellowstone for about 8 months before I got a permanent job at Grand Canyon National Park, and I was there for 7 years. Went to Yosemite for 4.5, and then Big Bend National Park in Texas for several years before coming here to Tennessee.
And all those places before the Smokies, like, do you have a favorite of any of those places that you worked in the past?
Well, they're all special. You know, every national park is somebody's
favorite.
It's like asking you
to name your favorite child.
That's correct. It's very much like that. And they're all dear to my heart for different reasons. You know, probably the most fun job I ever had was at Grand Canyon. I was a backcountry ranger there, spent most of my time in the inner canyon. But Big Bend was definitely near and dear to my heart. It's an amazing place. And I think the softer side of me loves that park dearly.
Now, I don't know Big Bend as well as a lot of the others, so what's that park like and what made it special to you?
Well, it's 800,000 acres, most of which is still largely wilderness, 240 miles of Rio Grande River along the border, 12% of the U.S.-Mexico border, some of the most beautiful canyons, 1,000-foot-walled river canyons, you know, that you'll find anywhere in the country. You can go on the river there for 5 days and not see a soul. It was amazing. And 5 mountain ranges all touch the area, you know, in that park. One range is contained entirely within the park, Chisos Mountains. And incredible biodiversity between the high Chisos and the ecosystem there, and then the wide-open Chihuahuan Desert, and then the river riparian area. So more migratory birds than anywhere in the country. I mean, just an incredible diversity.
That sounds beautiful, and the way you described it is beautiful. I have always wondered, you know, most of us experience these parks as visitors, and we go in there and we spend a day or a week or whatever it is, and it's breathtaking to us, and then we go away. But you and other people who do the jobs you do are there every single day. And I wonder is there ever a point for you at which you don't notice how gorgeous they are, or do you have to kind of shake yourself every once in a while and remind yourself, you know, the kind of place you're in?
You know, I think you hit that perfectly. It's not that people ask the question that's commonly asked is, do you get tired of seeing it? That is never true. You just cease to see it. It becomes part of your norm, and you don't always notice it. I think it's in the quiet moments, early in the morning when you first walk out your door. You know, until I moved here, I lived inside all of those national parks that I named. And so you would walk out the door and you were in the park. And in the quiet moments before everybody's up and running and, you know, the shuttle buses are moving and you know, everything's in gear for the day and you're headed to work, you look around, like early morning runs, you know, evening walks, and you're walking inside the national park, and that's when, you know, you're open to receiving it and seeing it again. And those are the moments that are probably most special.
I want to go back. So as a head ranger, you don't get to live in the park and at the Great Smokies?
No, that's a product of the park itself. A lot of parks, the chief ranger does live inside the park. The park itself, that's just the way it's structured. They don't have the employees living inside the park as much. There are some that do, but, in Big Bend, almost all of them do. Yosemite, a lot of them do. The Smokies was originally structured that way, and frankly, I don't know the full history as to why. I think they decided very early on they weren't going to build very many buildings in the park for housing purposes, and I don't necessarily disagree with that. You have a lot of support community all along the perimeter, which a lot of those other parks don't. So there's a lot of other places to live rather than building things inside our national park.
Yeah. I saw it as I was kind of reading up on you a little bit that you've been certified as a paramedic, a structural firefighter, a wildland firefighter, an aviation manager, and a swift water rescuer, among several other things. Now, are those all skills that you built up to sort of, you know, build your skills in the Park Service, or are those things that kind of pulled over from when you were thinking about law enforcement? You know, what made you decide to build that wide an array of skills?
No, I went into the Park Service literally, like, didn't even go to my graduation at Auburn, started my first job at Rocky while I was there, so there was nowhere else to get it. Like, it was all National Park Service, and the reality is that in most of the larger parks, again, you don't have the shoulder community to respond. You don't have the privilege of a Gatlinburg ambulance or fire department coming. So no one else is coming. So in those big Western parks, you are the structural fire department and the ambulance service, you know. And so you have to be trained to do all of that. You know, Grand Canyon and Yosemite have their own helicopters. Like, that is, you know, it is a required skill for working there and responding as an emergency provider in those parks.
Yeah. And so I always think about this one just because you mentioned, because y'all are the first and sometimes only responders in those situations. What are a couple of situations you've been in or experiences you've had where you sort of felt like maybe you were in the most danger, or maybe something where you didn't know if you're going to get out of it?
You know, I think that the things that pose a threat to the rescuer is the same thing that poses a threat to everyone else, which is, you know, bad weather and unpredictable weather. And I think that the most hairy situations I've been in were situations where we had to go after someone else who got in trouble in bad weather. So whether that was a snowstorm in July on Long's Peak at Rocky Mountain, you know, in really horrible weather, and people don't go in prepared for a snowstorm in July, right? So whether it's that situation or, you know, flash floods at Grand Canyon or, you know, horrible fire weather in Yosemite, like those are the situations when we are at risk because we're going after someone else who, you know, was out in weather and got into an unexpected situation. So I think honestly, it doesn't sound very exciting, but it's really about the weather.
Yeah. Well, back up and tell me a little bit. So this snowstorm in July, what was that like, and what difficulties did you face going into that?
Well, that happened frequently at Rocky Mountain National Park. You'll get snowstorms in July, and people will hike up into the high country there and not be prepared for that. And, you know, you'd have days, particularly in the Long's Peak area, where you'd have 40-mile-an-hour winds and sideways blowing snow, and your hiking partner, your rescue partner, would go in with you in the dark. And once you hit the tree line and were up in the wind, you could be 15 feet from them and not be able to hear or see them. So those were nights when you were out looking for a person who's injured out there, and you know, it seems like an impossible mission in those conditions. And it's of course cold and wet and all of the things that make it uncomfortable to begin with, and then, you know, add to it some incredibly extreme terrain, and it can be very sketchy.
So have you had experiences where you felt like, you know, I don't think we're going to find this person, and then you sort of managed to make it happen somehow?
Yeah, of course. You know, there's definitely instances where that happens, and I think, you know, every now and then someone you'll be to the point where you're not sure you're going to find them, and then you'll hear that whistle or that light will show up on the, you know, in the fog, and you'll be like, okay, I think that's where they're at. So, of course, sometimes it's really difficult, and the joy of finding them, you know, in a condition that you can actually, you know, viably help them is really rewarding.
So, also, obviously, the other thing you think about, you know, at the national parks is wildlife. So it sounds like with the parks you've been at, you've probably experienced just about everything that the American park system has to offer. So I wonder if you have a couple of encounters that you think about a lot. You know, when you're sitting around with other people telling stories about the things you've seen, I wonder if you have any sort of wildlife encounters that you think about.
Yeah, I think one of my most favorite was I was hiking up a slot canyon in Grand Canyon called Tuckup Canyon, and it's a, you know, 500-foot granite walls on both sides, and it's only about 30 or 40 feet across, so super narrow, and walking up that to pop out onto the next rim, and I heard this sound. It sounded like thunder. It was the craziest noise. I didn't know what it was, and it was coming down the canyon, and it was echoing off those walls, and it was so loud, and I'm like, what is that? So I, you know, sort of smashed myself up one side of the wall to sort of just get out of the way of whatever was coming down this canyon. And there was a small pour off, maybe 5 or 6 feet high, that was, you know, just in front of me, where the rock stepped down about 5 feet on the canyon floor. And around that corner came a full curl bighorn sheep. And he came ripping down through there. And he launched off of that, and it was almost like he was just running for the fun of it. And he launched off that pour off and saw me in midair and hit the ground and bounced and climbed up the opposite wall and what seemed like a sheer wall and took off up that canyon wall. It was the craziest thing. And it, I mean, we just looked at each other, and he got up there about 40 or 50 feet above me and looked down at me, and I looked up at him, and it was like, both of us were thinking, what are you doing here? So I was like...
That's a crazy, it's like a movie where it catches you, it spots you in midair, you know, and then has to decide to do what to do after that, you know, once it hits the other spot or whatever. Now, did that scare you, or did it just like,
the noise scared me? Yeah. As soon as I saw him, I wasn't afraid anymore, but yeah, I was just excited to see him because he was, you know, you don't realize how big they are because they're usually pretty far away. And you get a full adult ram like that and they're big. And as soon as I realized what he was, I wasn't afraid. But the noise, not knowing what was coming down, I just, you know, that's a really remote area of the canyon. There's not a lot of wildlife. And so when you hear sounds like that and you don't know what it is, it's very hard to imagine what's coming. You don't know.
When we come back, Lisa Hendy works in a place where most people go on vacation. So where does she go on vacation? That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Karen Wall Porter, an educator in Alabama, who enjoyed my conversation with Harvard professor Tony Jack about the issues that underprivileged students have at elite universities. Here's what Karen said on Twitter. Living in a university town, I was particularly interested in this week's episode of the Southbound Podcast. Thank you, Tommy, for bringing us Tony Jack to push our thinking and to challenge us to see beyond our experiences and look for those standing right in our face. Thank you, Karen, and thanks to everyone else who shared and commented on this episode. If you're listening today and you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you leave us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps Southbound get out there to even more listeners. Thanks again for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Lisa Hendy. So explain a little bit about what the title of Chief Ranger, what does that entail?
So a lot of people think that that is the lead supervisor in the park. The superintendent is the head of the national park, so that's who I work for. Each division in the national park has a chief. So there's a chief for facilities maintenance. There's a chief of resource education or interpretation, and that's who is the lead in it, educating the public. My job as Chief Ranger is emergency response. So we are there for law enforcement, EMS, search and rescue, and in many parks, fire. I do oversee the wildland fire program in the Smokies. So it's the emergency response component, and that's what the Chief Ranger oversees in most parks.
And are there things along those lines that make the Great Smokies Park more difficult or unique among the parks?
I just think the sheer number of visitors, it is the most visited park in the country. It's got, highways coming in from multiple directions in two different states and several jurisdictions. And, all of those things make it complex from a law enforcement standpoint. It is accessible, more so than many of the other big Western parks. And so, you can have a visitor who just drives up for the day. And, when we talk about, preparedness and weather, I think that's one of the things. You come up from Knoxville, it might be 80 degrees, but if we've got a cloud hanging at Newfound Gap, it might be 50 degrees. And if you decided to go for a hike before that cloud came in and you weren't ready for it, that might make for a rough day. So, I think that accessibility is wonderful. It's great that all of these millions of people around the Eastern Seaboard have got this amazing resource in their backyard, but it's got its challenges too, because they may not fully perceive the hazards that it poses. It may not seem to them like the wilderness that it is.
Yeah, I noticed that very thing. I was over there, maybe 6-8 weeks ago, and just drove through the park from the kind of Sevierville Pigeon Forge side. And it was pretty warm when I drove into the park, but as I got up higher, there was still snow on the ground. The other thing I noticed when I was there was that even though it wasn't summer yet or even a big, holiday weekend or something, there were a lot of crowds around the trailheads and the overlooks. So how do you handle that, deal with that? Are there times when the park feels, might feel overcrowded to people, that sort of thing?
Oh, I'm sure it does. We each have our own tolerance for, cultural tolerances for the number of people around us and when we'd perceive that to be too many. And that's an interesting challenge for the National Park Service on the whole, is determining, where's that tipping point for our visitors and when does it become too much? And how do we accommodate that? Like, how do we preserve their experience in the midst of the popularity of the parks? And I think it's something that all of the parks are struggling with. It's wonderful to have the support and the visitation, but as we grow in popularity, we're having to explore how we're going to help preserve that experience for everyone. As far as the Smokies, you know, I think just the sheer volume of people does create a special challenge here. And I think there are a lot of opportunities to improve in how we manage to help preserve those experiences. But there's also an incredible number of really great people in the park that dedicate every day to trying to figure out the best way to do that.
I wonder also, you mentioned a little earlier about, you know, this is a park where that's close to a lot of things, so people might come there for the day trip. And obviously, as I'm sure you well know, that area around the park is really touristy. You know, there's all these, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not places and pancake shops and strip malls and that sort of thing. And when a park has that sort of stuff around it, as opposed to really being in the wilderness, do you tend to get, like, different issues or a different type of clientele inside the park?
I just think that it becomes accessible. It creates a perception that you're still within the reaches of civilization. And, you know, it's 500,000 acres of, you know, largely undeveloped wilderness out there. And so when you leave the pancake shop, since you mentioned them, you know, in the morning, and you go out to experience your park, you know, you may not prepare the same as you might if you left a pancake shop in Bozeman and then drove into Yellowstone, right? Because it took a little bit more effort to actually get into Yellowstone and to get out into that park. And so, you know, all I'm saying is that, you know, it's about people's perception as they depart civilization so close to the park boundary and then enter the park. They don't necessarily make the mental transition to, oh, I need to be more situationally aware, paying attention to, you know, the hazards in this environment, because I've walked into a totally different environment. This is not simply an extension of Gatlinburg.
I think the question I really wanted to ask you, and I sort of talked around it the first time, is when it's a sort of a day tripper or a more touristy kind of thing, maybe people who didn't even plan to go to the park, but they were there for, you know, something else. Do the people who are sort of more dedicated visitors tend to behave better than sort of the day tripper, so to speak?
You know, I don't know that we have any sort of statistics or measurements to be able to bear that out. You know, that it might seem intuitive, but I don't have any way to show that. I think that if you're returning to the park, you probably have an intrinsic relationship with that park for yourself. You know, it means something to you. And I think that if you're a return visitor and you've come there specifically for the Smokies, you're going to treat the park differently than someone who's come to visit Pigeon Forge or Gatlinburg and happens into the park. That's just the mindset you're in upon arrival. And I don't think that that's an intentional thing on anyone's part. I think that's just how they choose to approach it.
So how does the park look and feel different than it did when you went, when you were, you know, out of high school, college, you know, however long ago?
It's different in that you have a totally different eye for the park when you've spent 25 years working for the Park Service. You know, this is my first visit to a actual studio in the NPR stations. I imagine you hang out in these locations all the time. So for me, this is like a very different place. And my eyes walking in here see things differently than someone who's been working in radio for 20 years. I'm looking at things that the visitor doesn't even notice. So to ask me, you know, how does it look different? It's light years different. But I'm looking at things that I didn't look at when I was 16. I'm looking at, you know, what is the visitor accessibility? How many of our signs are in a foreign language? Do we have enough parking for everyone? Is there litter on the ground? You know, the 16-year-old's like, where's the bathroom? You know, I mean, it's a totally different eye for the place. You know?
Yeah. So in terms of you know, helping with law enforcement and that sort of thing, what are the common things that tend to happen that you have to deal with sort of day in and day out?
Honestly, it's traffic violations. It's people you know, driving in such a manner that, you know, they get in a hurry, and the roads are windy and you have to slow down considerably. When it's crowded around a trailhead, the traffic parking spills out into the roadway and along the roadway. So it's traffic management and people management in some of those high crowded areas. That's the vast majority of it. And then dealing with people who become frustrated and therefore perhaps a little bit ill-behaved as a result of the traffic problems.
I want to ask a little bit. So I know you're the first woman to hold this job at the Smokies Park. Are there many women who hold this type of job at any of the national parks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, for this job, there were three chief rangers who were women that applied. It's not uncommon.
Okay.
It just happens to be this park's first chief.
Well, I was wondering, as sort of America as a whole is sort of reevaluating how women have been treated in the workplace over the years. I'm wondering, you've been doing this for 25 years now. Have you encountered pushback or resistance or any of that sort of thing over the years from colleagues or patrons or anybody?
Oh, I've got pushback, but I don't think it was related to me being a female. if you look at a career, doing this job, I've actually was very fortunate, and then I had a great deal of support from the vast majority of the supervisors that I worked under, and never felt truly curtailed by any of them. I think, honestly, I got more snide comments from visitors, my favorites were, oh, they let the girl rangers carry guns.
And,
they let you hike out here all by yourself. And yeah, I would get those comments from the visitors more than anyone else.
Yeah. Would you ever say anything?
Probably, but I don't sure I'm in a position to share those.
That's great. I'll just let my imagination work on that then. I was wondering if, you worked at a lot of different places. Is that just sort of natural for somebody who does what you do, or did you set out to kind of go around and work in all these different places?
No, it's normal within the Park Service for people to move fairly frequently. And, in many parks, actually in all of the parks I've worked in, you'll have those people that spend their entire career in one park. And the Park Service needs that because you need somebody who has that, historic knowledge of the place to provide continuity, But it is very common for people to move around quite a bit within their career. And it's a small agency, so you tend to know people in a lot of different places throughout the agency. So it's very, very common.
This is sort of digression here, but when I talked to people and told them that I was going to talk to you and that you were starting this new job at Smokies, several people had the same question, and I don't know if you've been around long enough to answer this or not, or if you know definitively, but everybody wanted to know, so are there mountain lions in the park or not?
I don't know. It's certainly not something they're putting a lot of energy into advertising, so I haven't. I will tell you this, I have had the opportunity. I mean, I've been on the job for 30 days,
right.
And so my knowledge is extraordinarily limited. And I have worked quite a bit in that 30 days with our wildlife management experts and, talked to them about bears. I've talked to them about wild hogs. We've talked to them about, all of the threats posed by those two animals. And at no time have mountain lions come up. So that's all I know to tell you.
That's the evidence, yeah. I know I read up on this a little bit. I guess they've been officially extinct there since like the 20s. But I guess every once in a while, it crops up that people have a purported sighting or they hear something in the woods or something like that. I guess that's probably like maybe a ghost story that people tend to hear what they want to hear or something like that. I don't know.
Maybe. No one has commented on the local Yeti population yet either, so I'm unaware.
Well, I would appreciate it if you would let us know if there are
yes,
good
sir,
signs
will,
of those.
You will be my first call.
Yeah. You work in a place where most people go on their vacations. So what do you do when you go on vacation?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. So early in my career, I would go visit other rangers in other parks because I had a free place to stay. So that's what I did for a long time. But now I travel overseas a lot. That's what I like to do. And of course, I visit other national parks all over the world. And it is a joy to see America's best idea propagating like it has.
Is there some other country or some other place that does national parks really well?
Oh, there's many, many others. New Zealand has a fantastic, their version of a park system. It's a conservation system. I spent some time last year in Kruger National Park in South Africa, and Angkor Wat in Cambodia is actually a national historic site for Cambodia. The World Heritage Site, that whole concept of a World Heritage Site, those are all over the world, naturally. So Angkor Wat, the pyramids at Giza, Petra, so I've been to all of those places, and it's really interesting to see how other countries are managing the same problems we have. You know, how do you deal with a huge influx of people, protect your site from degradation, from the foot traffic, but also graffiti and vandalism, and how do you protect people while they're there? It's all the same problems all over the world, and it's fun to go to those places and see how other countries are working on that. I got an opportunity to be the Yosemite ambassador to Berchtesgaden National Park. The Park Service has a sister park program where we learn from each other, and Berchtesgaden is in Germany, and it's especially fun to go to a park like that. We went to a trail. There were no trash cans anywhere in this really busy area, and I asked about that, and they said, as soon as we removed the trash cans, people quit throwing trash. Like, there was no litter anywhere. And it was super counterintuitive. And they're like, yeah, we just took the trash cans out. And then there was people stopped bringing trash. There's no litter anywhere. And I was like, wow. So, like, you would never think that. But yeah, it's been fun to watch how other parks are managed.
Yeah. And so now that you've come back to this place that you first came to long ago with all this, experience in between, when you first came back to the Smokies a month ago, was there something you saw or experienced or, heard or whatever that sort of brought back that kind of sense of wonder that you had way back at the beginning?
Yeah, I think the thing that gets my attention most driving through the park now, and again, it's only been 30 days, is the canopy of trees. I've been living out west in mostly conifer forests or wide open desert, and I love those places. But it is really fun to see the sunlight come through the trees like it does here. And you just don't see that in many places out west. So that's been probably one of the most welcoming sights.
The national parks are America's best idea. That's adapted from a line by the writer Wallace Stegner. America has come up with a lot of great ideas, from the Bill of Rights to Post-it notes, but the national parks have to make just about anybody's list. Even on the busiest days in places like Great Smoky Mountains National Park, you could park your car and get on a trail, and pretty soon you're in the wilderness, experiencing life in a way you never could in the city. So much of what makes the park system work is the people like Lisa Hendy, who work behind the scenes, invisible unless we need them. It's easy for us to be jaded by whatever we might see every day, even if it's spectacular beauty. It did me good to hear the wonder in Lisa Hendy's voice, and she talked about something as simple as the trees in the Smokies. That might not make the top 20 things I notice in the park, but it's a good reminder of all we can see we take the time to just look at the world with a fresh eye. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jessa O'Connor. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you like to listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.